The following commentary is for educational purposes only. Always consult the appropriate tax, legal, or financial professionals before acting on any information heard in this program.
Welcome to the IRA Brothers Podcast. I'm Nick Edwards.
And I'm Nathan Edwards.
And this is episode number 7. We've been covering the different types of IRAs and employer-sponsored plans that you can use to save for retirement. And now we're going to kind of group everything together from the employer-sponsored side and add a little additional element to it. And we're going to talk about the difference between defined contribution plans and defined benefit plans. Let's start with the easy one, Nate. What's a defined contribution plan?
So when we hear the word pension, we typically think of an amount that is paid to us at some future date that has been guaranteed by our employer. But in reality, there are two distinct types of pension plans, and that is the defined contribution plan and the defined benefit plan. So what most people think about when they think of pensions would be classified as a defined benefit plan. We'll get to that in a little bit. The defined contribution plan actually includes some of the things that we've already covered. Those would be 401ks, 403bs. That's actually probably all that we've covered so far, but those actually are considered defined contribution plans in that with a defined contribution plan, the employer or the employee or both contribute to that plan on a regular basis with the expectation that upon retirement, they will be able to supplement their income with the dollars accrued in that account. Now, one of the big characteristics of a defined contribution plan is that the investment risk is solely on the employee. Right? So the employer's obligation, if any, is to contribute into the account. Once that contribution is made into an individual employee's account, all of the investment risk is on the employee. Whatever happens after that point is based on the decisions that the employee has made about those dollars. And so if they invest them according to strategy Y, and strategy Y goes up, they would have more money by the time that they have retired. And if they invest it in strategy X, and strategy X goes down, they might have less money by the time that they retire.
So the real easy way to remember defined contribution plans is that what is defined by the plan is the contribution. In other words, what is put into it is set typically by the employee, but a portion of that may be kind of a regular addition to that contribution from the employer side. And by the way, I should just quickly mention, in case we start using any shorthand here, if we say DC, we're talking about defined contribution plan, and DB will be defined benefit plan. Sometimes we slip up and do that.
So one exception to this, or one of the exceptions to this, is something called the money purchase plan.
And this is in the defined contribution category, correct?
This is, yeah. So this is under the defined contribution. So unlike a 401k where the employer doesn't actually have to make any contributions to it, there's something called a money purchase plan. And under this plan, the employer has to contribute on an annual basis to each employee's account, not each employee's, but qualifying employees' accounts, at a fixed rate. And when I say fixed rate, that doesn't mean fixed dollar amount, but typically it's a fixed percentage of the employee's income on an annual basis. And so this is getting closer to what many people think of when they think of a pension plan. So with a money purchase plan, the employee might not have to do anything. It might just be their employer contributing to an account for them on a regular basis, although the employee would still probably have to make the investment decisions within that account. And so certainly, at least at the very minimum, the investment risk will still be on the employee's shoulders.
Okay, so now maybe we should start talking about the difference between the DC or defined contribution plan and the defined benefit plan.
On the defined contribution side, the biggest difference is who shoulders the investment risk.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, it's the employee, correct?
That's correct.
On the defined benefit side, the employer and the employee enter into an agreement by which the employer promises some future benefit upon the employee's termination of employment. Now, typically, this can either be a fixed dollar amount. Say, if you retire at age 62, we'll give you $500 a month and it will increase by inflation or something like that. But more frequently, we see it attached to some formula. And that formula is based on something like number of years, high 5-year average of salary.
Age.
Age, of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then that is also sometimes occasionally attached to a cost of living increase on the back end as well. Now, you'll notice that if they promise this benefit in advance, right? So if I go and work at a new company and they promise me that upon my retirement, they will apply this formula to my specific situation, that means that they have to provide that benefit. There's nothing that I can do other than showing up to work and earning a specific amount of money to change that benefit, which means that the investment risk is on the employer.
That's right, because they have to make it happen when you meet the qualifying terms of that agreement.
That's right. So there are dollars going into an account. It's usually a trust fund of some sort. Actually, I'm pretty sure it's always a trust fund of some sort. But they then have to manage those assets so that they can pay for those benefits, both current and future obligations. And so it is very critical that they are able to do that according to the future obligations that they believe that they have.
So what is that, and I know it varies greatly between employers, but what does that typically look like when an employer is trying to determine what they would need to do to provide the benefits for these current employees at a future date?
It is very difficult.
What kind of assumptions are they looking at?
So there are a lot of assumptions that have to be made. The first of which is, what is the formula going to be that is going to produce the benefit at a future date? Right, so every employee will have that formula applied to them, depending on when they started working, presumably. But then the managers of the fund also have to understand how long they expect for an individual to live once they retire, how long they expect the average employee to work. You know, are they going to vest for these benefits? Are they going to switch jobs and not receive a full benefit? They also need to consider an investment return, right? So if I'm going to work for a company, you know, I start my job at age 21 and I expect my full retirement age is age 62. They need to know how much they plan on earning on their dollars that they're contributing on my behalf into this trust fund. What are they going to earn on that?
And this brings up an interesting point. Is it typically the person managing the assets within the plan on behalf of the employer, or is it the employer making these assumptions? Because this is where we've seen people recently get into a lot of trouble with pension plans on the defined benefit side not working out the way they had planned when they originally created them.
Well, that depends. It depends on how the employer said. I mean, hypothetically, the employer could go and try to manage it themselves, but that would be an awful lot of work to manage that, even if you had more than a few employees.
Right.
So oftentimes, this is outsourced to a third party who does this professionally, you know, because obviously there are regulatory requirements, and just coming up with those assumptions and doing the math and doing the job is quite the undertaking. But one of the biggest factors, as I mentioned, is that assumed rate of return, which we call the discount rate, right? They have to look to see, okay, what is the liability going to be in the future, and what do we have to earn in the years in between now and that future date to make that happen? And what we're presently seeing now is that there were a lot of assumptions made, you know, 20, 30 years ago that have not fully been realized.
Right.
And so we are having a problem presently, and not necessarily, it could be a problem for some, that a lot of these pension funds don't look quite as healthy as they should because they used return assumptions that were just too high. They were appropriate for the time period that they were established in, but over time, return assumptions have changed, and they haven't always been able to fully realize those returns.
And of course, the tragedy of that is that once employees have been working at a company for 10, 15, 20 years, they don't want to find out that they're going to have to suffer a reduction in their pension benefits. But a lot of people are getting that kind of news now because the employers and the people managing the money are looking at this and saying, look, even though these were reasonable assumptions at the time we created this, based on today's environment with ultra, ultra low interest rates, a market that's been relatively stagnant, we've had a few huge crashes here, it's looking like this is not going to work. So something has to change. And the question always is who's going to pay the price for that change? So let me give you two real life examples that we have experienced here relatively recently at our firm with two different client scenarios. The first was someone that was an employee with the Teamsters. He was a long haul truck driver. He worked for a parcel delivery service here in town, but they're a national service. And a couple of years ago, and some of you may recall hearing about this, they realized, as Nathan has been describing, that their pension plan was in trouble. They had made some assumptions early on, and this organization has been around for years, that seemed reasonable at the time, but as more time had gone by and they suffered through this kind of economic environment that we've been in, they realized things weren't working. So they put together a package to send to the federal government because this was truly one of those too big to fail scenarios. There may have been as many as a million employees that were tied up in this. And they said to the government, hey, we think we can probably make this work with a little bit of effort. Here's how we're going to do it. Can you help us out if we can get this much done? And I actually got to take a look at the proposal that they sent to the government, and they used some rate of return assumptions that were just ridiculous. Even by our standards, we look at this and go, there's no way that you can say with any degree of certainty you can actually get this. And it turns out the government felt the same way. So they kind of pushed it back across the desk and said, I don't think so, guys. This isn't going to work. So the only choice that they were left with was to notify these employees that they were going to have to substantially cut their pension benefits. I'm talking about as much as 50%. So that's one of the ways that they can get around these problems in the private sector. If they realize it's not going to work, is just cut the benefit to the employees, and they're the ones that are going to have to pay the price.
Here's an interesting thought that actually goes with that specific example. We hear a lot today about the automation of vehicles, right? So what if in the next 10 years we actually do have a large-scale automation of long-haul trucking, for an example? Another one of those pension plan assumptions is how many current employees are contributing to the plan which can help pad the benefits of those that are currently receiving plans.
That's right. It's just like Social Security. They look and say, hey, we got all these young people now that'll be That's helping right. to pay the benefits in
and
the future.
So they're contributing dollars. We can utilize those dollars. So this is all built into the formula.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the workforce of the companies that are funding this pension are reduced, so the pension is lopsided, right? They've got more people who are retired than are currently working. What do you think happens to those funds if they're already under stress? So in other words, if the amount of new contributions is decreasing, now that's not to say that the company won't become exponentially more profitable, you know, because of the automation and not having to pay humans to do these things.
And the problem, of course, with that is everyone always assumes that their company
sure,
is
sure.
going to be healthy and vibrant for years.
Correct. These are just the things that we have to think about moving forward. It's not just now. With something like a defined benefit plan, we're talking about years and years and years into the future. And so this is not easy stuff. And it's not necessarily the fault of pension managers for getting to this point, but perhaps it is the fault of pension managers and the organizations that manage the pensions for not more quickly correcting assumptions when they saw problems arise.
Well, let's talk about one more thing, because this has come up a lot more recently because of the situation we're running into with these pensions, and that's the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is one kind of backstop that's out there. Nate, what is the PBGC?
So the PBGC actually provides a form of pension insurance, if you will, up to certain caps and within certain limitations. And this is for private sector pensions. So
mm-hmm.
this is for corporate pensions. The government actually does provide this backstop. Now, you do not necessarily want your pension to fall into the hands of the PBGC as the trustee of the pension, because in our experience, it is a long and arduous process. Yes, it's great that it's there, and it's great that people are able to get something out of it, but it is definitely not a panacea.
Right. It's like getting insurance on your house. You're glad that you've got it there, but you don't want to go through the process of having to make a
sure.
claim against that.
Sure.
And just real quickly, since we're on the subject, let me tell you what, because we get this question often, you know, my company's kind of in trouble. I'm a little bit worried about it. What will the PBGC cover if it actually gets to that point? Well, here are the most recent numbers for 2017, and you can look this up online on their website. And this changes year to year. It goes up a little bit for inflation, and it will also depend on the year that you start taking the benefit from the PBGC if it gets to that point. Right now in 2017, the maximum monthly benefit for a single person drawing claims who is also age 65, and this changes by age, is $5,369 per month. And of course, that goes down a little bit if you've got a spouse on the plan or something like that. And for most people, they may look at that and go, well, that sounds like a pretty high number. But I've got another example where even that wasn't enough to fully make somebody whole. Several years ago, I had a client that was a pilot for a major airline, and the airline got into trouble with their pension. In fact, the airline went bankrupt and they couldn't pay out their pension. And this guy's expected monthly benefit was around $8,000 a month. And at the time, the PBGC benefit was around $4,500 a month. So he had to take about a 50% haircut on his. So again, yes, it's nice that you've got something there as a backstop, but don't expect, if you're a high paid employee and expecting a big pension, that it will cover all of it. You should know what those limits are.
And so those are for private sector jobs. Many people that we see today that are accruing benefits on the defined benefit side are employees of a governmental organization. And that is because, in large part, a lot of corporations have shifted to either taking pension or offering pension buyouts or switching entirely to defined contribution plans, because defined benefit pension plans have become onerous to manage. So these governmental organizations, they don't have the same backstop as private organizations. They don't have the PBGC. They are backed by the claims paying ability of the governmental organization. So
that's
if
right.
it's a local government, if it's a city or something like that, if it's a state, the federal government, it's backed by the claims paying ability of that organization. Obviously, we would assume and hope that the higher the organization, the better able that it would be to meet those claims, because they could just increase taxes potentially at the federal level or at a state level or city level. But that's not always the case.
Well, and we've got another perfect example of that here locally in Jacksonville. They have just recently passed a new bit of legislation that has added an additional half-cent sales tax to cover a struggling pension plan for our police and fire department and the local municipality. But even with that benefit, to at least keep the thing functional a little bit longer, a couple of years ago, they had to completely revise the terms of the defined benefit plan, and now it's not nearly as lucrative as it used to be. So again, like Nathan's saying, there's really a hard push to go back to, let's reconsider whether we're going to keep offering defined benefit plans to people, and let's consider defined contribution. We want to encourage you, employee, to do that so you can take some of this burden off of us.
And here's another thing to consider. We mentioned earlier on the defined contribution side that the investment risk is squarely on the employee's shoulders.
That's right.
In a defined benefit plan, the investment risk is squarely on the employer's shoulders. There are actual dollars associated with this account. There are dollars inside of account that are earmarked for paying off these benefits. These dollars are invested in things, so they are exposed to various types of risks. One big one being investment risk or market risk or interest rate risk. I just said one big one and then named several, but you get what I mean.
I get you.
If there is a big shock, and when there is a big shock in the economy, these funds can suffer the same adversity as anybody else. And so if they're already struggling and then they receive a shock, things can get bad quickly. Now, I know that all of this is very scary, right? So we've just talked about defined benefit plans and all the problems that have been going on. But we don't want you to assume that we're saying, oh, take your own money and assume the investment risk and everything will be great. Our whole purpose in bringing this up here and now is because a lot of people are participating blindly in programs that they take for granted that they will be there at some future date, and it might just not be the case. So our plea to everyone is know your plans and know your options. If you work for an employer and the only option is a defined benefit plan, and that defined benefit plan happens to be struggling, unless you want to go and get a different job, you might be stuck with that, and you just have to hope that it works out, but you should plan accordingly. You know, maybe you'll need to supplement your own retirement income. If you have other options and you know the plan that you are able to enroll in is struggling, well, maybe you do want to bear some of that investment risk. And a lot of plans now are also offering hybrid options where you can take part of the defined benefit plan and part of the defined contribution plan as well. So really what we're saying is not that all defined benefit plans are bad. In fact, some defined benefit plans are excellent in what you would be hard-pressed to be able to recreate the benefits provided by these plans on your own. And those are for well-funded plans that have realistic assumptions, and they have a real shot of existing long into the future. You would definitely want to consider participation in a plan like that. However, we are also aware of some woefully underfunded plans that folks are just not aware that they are exposed to that future risk, and so they are not taking the appropriate steps to become prepared for what could be an eventual shock to them.
So let's wrap up with something very practical here, and we'll do a little role-playing. And this is between Nathan and I and what we're seeing in our local marketplace kind of become a burr in our saddle. There is a defined benefit plan available to a lot of the employees of the state, but as we just mentioned, even the state of Florida, with all of its taxation ability and everything else, is looking at this and saying, well, we'd really like to try to get more people out of this defined benefit plan. We want to give them the option of choosing a defined contribution plan if they want to, and we see that they've offered, unfortunately, a relatively small amount of evaluation information to the employees so that they can make a good decision as far as which one they're going to choose. And because they are enlisting the help of a lot of private enterprises like us to go and help these people make decisions, you've got conflicts of interest that are being injected into this decision-making process. So Nate, let's just take a quick, very sterile look at this and just assume I come to you and I said, I don't know what to do. I've been working for 20 years. This pension benefit looks really, really nice, but this defined contribution side also looks pretty savory because if I do that, I don't have to rely on monthly payments coming and I get all of this money at once. What would you say to me?
It is very difficult to answer that question. So in the state of Florida anyway, and the fund that Nick is referring to is the Florida Retirement System, or FRS as it's known, and they have two sides. They've got the defined benefit side and the defined contribution side. They call the defined benefit side the retirement or the pension plan, and they call the investment side the FRS investment plan. Making that decision cannot be, this is better than that one.
Right.
One, it's highly dependent on your personal situation and what you're trying to achieve. Two, the state is presently very proud of their pension plan. It's one of the best funded plans in the nation. I don't have that number right in front of me, but I believe it's in the 80s. Back in 2008, it was 106% funded. So before the financial crisis, they had more money than they needed to pay all future obligations. But we can see how time and return assumptions and broader economic activity can impact a plan's funded status. So going back to our point, it is a comparatively well-funded pension plan. Given that, without any more major shocks to the plan, which who knows, the plan should be able to exist pretty far into the future. So someone retiring today, we would expect that they should be able to receive pension benefits for the rest of their life. And there's no guarantee that that would occur, but based on the current funded status of the plan and the other actions that they've taken to kind of shore up the plan, we believe that that should be possible.
Now, here's one of the biggest risks that I see, and this is just a human nature kind of thing. We see people who like the idea of being able to gain control of all of that money that would be set aside. Because what happens is when you buy die out of the pension plan, they actually give you a lump sum of money. And now it's up to you, as Nate said before, to make the investment results that they were projecting actually happen. And for just reference purposes, they're shooting for around 7.6% as their rate of return assumption. But by and large, and this happens, I'd say, well over 50% of the time, people look at that and go, oh, geez, I'm not that great of an investor, and I certainly don't want to lose any money. So what they do is they get really, really conservative on that, and they get so conservative that you look at it and go, there's no way you're going to come anywhere close to what their rate of return assumption was. So now, even though you have this big pot of money, which may have been more than you've ever had in your savings in your life, you've actually condemned yourself to running out of money at some point, because your rate of return that you're actually going to get will probably be much less than that rate of return assumption the state was going to use, and you also don't have the taxing power and authority that the state could have used to try to bump that back up if they run into
trouble.
And
that's absolutely right. And that's a great point, because it is truly a double-edged sword. I mean, this is a very troubling prospect right now across the nation and maybe across the world. People are faced with the prospect of having to either accept a defined benefit, which is really strong. You know, they see these benefits that they've been promised, but these benefits are eating the fund. It could potentially, these very strong benefits could potentially be the death of the fund.
That's right.
So someday they go bust and they get nothing or some diminished proportion of that. Or they could take their pension buyout and try to match these extraordinary rates of return on their own, and honestly have a very low probability of meeting those goals. Because we're talking about your average Tom, Dick, and Harry trying to meet the performance, investment performance projections of some of the best investors in the world, right? So these large pensions, the state of Florida, for example, hundreds of billions of dollars. In fact, in investment expenses alone, they spend over $500 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
So can you imagine what type of money management talent you could buy for $500 million a year? And we have, you know, Joe Schmo who thinks, I could do that. You know, I can make these returns because the S&P has done...
Well, and not only that, but the state of Florida, because they have such a massive plan, gains access to different types
That's
of
right.
investments than the regular average Joe could get.
It is a very difficult choice. So to answer your question, I can't tell you which one to choose. Maybe one is better than the other based on your personal financial objectives and your personal situation, but it's also in large part going to be a matter of your personal preference and the math and the probability of one of these few things happening and what you believe that that is. And you have to, at the end of the day, feel comfortable with the decision that you've made, which means that you have to perform some due diligence. Now, yes, of course, you can go and seek outside professional counsel to help you perform that due diligence, but at the end of the day, you have to think about it. You have to make those decisions, because it has gotten critically important that you at least consider the potential outcomes of the choices that you make with regard to your pension plan.
That's right. And let's even look at the flip side of the problem I described earlier, where people get too conservative. Some people say, you know what, I'm kind of a savvy investor. I get that I need to try to get a higher rate of return. I'm going to take a little bit more risk with it. But even in that case, if you've got the best, or maybe I should say luckiest, investment advisor and stock picker in the world, you could have a huge economic crash and actually wind up with even less money than you started with because you're trying to be more aggressive.
Very difficult.
Another problem that can be associated with trying to do it on your own.
And I know that all of this has seemed very scary in large, but if anything, I hope what we've accomplished out of this episode is to allow people to realize that they can't take their pension for granted. They have to explore their options, they have to explore the dollars behind the plan, and they have to explore the people behind those dollars. People meaning the companies that are managing it, or the expectations that they've set, or the assumptions that they've made. At the end of the day, we don't want to try to talk people into one type of pension or another. We just want them to know what decision they are making and why they have made that decision. Because even if a pension plan, for example, is teetering on the brink of death, believe it or not, it could still actually be a better option for someone than an alternative. And so it is individually dependent, and the research needs to be done in that context.
And that is a very brief and possibly somewhat horrifying description of a defined contribution versus defined benefit pension plan.